Willkommen zu Unruhige Zeiten, dem Podcast vom und für den Mittelstand.
Herzlich willkommen zu Unruhige Zeiten, dem Podcast von TTE Strategy. Und ich bin Lars Lindekogel und spreche alle paar Wochen mit Entscheidern, Unternehmern und spannenden Persönlichkeiten von Mittelstand-Champions. Und heute haben wir eine spannende Episode wieder auf Englisch. A very warm welcome. Our guest today is the CEO of ADA Metal Packaging, Oliver Graham. And your company's products are known all over the world. Consumers are using them millions of times every day, and you can find them on supermarket shelves, in your fridge, and at events. It's a company that generates around $5 billion in annual revenue. Welcome, Oliver Graham, Global CEO of ADA Metal Packaging.
Thanks, Lars.
Pleasure having you here in Hamburg. You're based in London. How many times a year are you coming to Germany?
Not so many now. Maybe one or two. When I was running our European business, I used to come a lot. We have 4 plants here. We have our administrative and technical center in Bonn, but now a bit less, unfortunately.
Yeah, so it's a big pleasure having you.
Even better to be here
in Hamburg. Yeah. Sorry for the weather, as usual, but if you're from London.
It doesn't really change much. Not such a big shock.
So we have known each other for many years, and I'm very proud that you are on the podcast because now I can finally ask you everything.
Slightly worrying.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
Die Vita.
Olli, you studied history in Cambridge, have worked for more than 20 years for Boston Consulting Group in consumer and retail, then moved to executive roles in packaging. What did studying history in Cambridge teach you that still shapes how you think today?
Yeah, it's like my BCG interview convincing them that history was a good idea for consulting. So I think it's quite an analytical subject. You have to think about your argument. You have to think about what matters in your argument, what doesn't matter. You create your story. So I think it helps you simplify and clarify your thinking and have, obviously, you know, sparring partners and stretch yourself. So yeah, I always convinced everyone that it was a very analytical subject.
And why did you choose history? What was the story behind your intention there?
Yeah, there was quite a lot of family background. My father taught ancient history and classics at universities. My mother also wrote some history, but I liked it at school. I mean, the usual things, I guess.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about later how you evaluate the current times in the big picture of history. So I'm expecting quite a bit from that. But then you shifted from being a partner at BCG to leading a global packaging company as the CEO. When you think about that shift, what did you have to learn? And were there also things that you had to unlearn from being consulting to an executive?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually found the transition easier than I expected. I found that there was And I moved initially into a central role in a company called Wrexham. And in central roles, you need still a lot of the consulting skill set. You know, you still need to be collaborative, to add value, to show that you're helping people. Because you can't always sort of ring the CEO and say, oh, they're not doing what I tell them to do it. This doesn't work. So you still need that skill set, I think, in those central roles. Once I took on the real P&L operational role, the main thing I was struck by was this cycle of financial reporting. You know, the monthly, the quarterly, the annual, the budgeting, the reforecasting. This is very strong and something that in consulting you just don't really get into, and you miss something that is very high on the executive's mind. And it's also much more, you manage it much more than there's a lot of messaging around it. So that was a big thing I had to learn. I think in unlearning, I mean, maybe it is some of the decision making, but actually I found that relatively straightforward to get into sort of decision making and making choices and moving on. So yeah, I found it relatively seamless, actually.
So is that an advice to consultants to understand better this financial reporting cycle?
So yeah, I think if you're not in the head of the executive a little bit there, then you're missing something that is definitely on their mind, you know, on a very regular basis.
So we'll remember that. Thank you very much. If you go back in time, what advice would you give the young history graduate Ollie Graham, or maybe your children today, about a professional career in the context of life?
I mean, much tougher today, right? I think trying to advise them, and this is my children are at this age, you know, of what will be the world of work and what jobs are going to look like with AI coming. I think we're not prepared, really, as a society. And I find it quite difficult to advise them. If I go back to myself, I actually think, you know, that I didn't know really what to do. And therefore, the choice I made, the BCG choice that would sponsor me to business school, you know, I'm happy. I think that was a good choice to just open up and do some different things and create some options. And that, maybe this is the advice, which is, unless you're very clear, you know, since the age of five, what you want to be, may create options, look around, see what suits you, see where you fit.
And in business school, is that still, in because you mentioned AI, is that still a topic? Should people still go to business schools, you think, or how would you evaluate that now?
I think so. I mean, a lot of business school is also about other people, the network, the challenge, the opening again your mind to different cultures, different ways of thinking and working. I think that still remains. Yeah.
Okay. So let's shift gears and talk about business, busy or turbulent times.
Unruhige Zeiten.
Olli, I mentioned it already before we dive into business. From your perspective as a historian, are we actually living in what we call in German unruhige Zeiten, or is this all relative?
I mean, we clearly are living in some turbulent times, right? I think, you know, the unwinding of some very fixed structures that were helping govern the world and the way we live is pretty dramatic. I think we maybe exaggerate that it can't go back, but we clearly are living in some busy times. I think we do easily forget that through history there's been lots of very difficult times, and maybe the illusion is created by the fact that we had this period of more stable international affairs. But equally, I grew up in the Cold War. You know, I remember worrying quite a lot about the potential for nuclear conflict, right? And we easily forget these things. So I think it's fair to say there have always been busy times, but no doubt this is a moment.
Okay. So when you think back about how you grew up and what you had on your mind at the time, maybe also what your parents thought about it, when you think about you as a parent today, is it a similar feeling, or is it still a little bit unreal that things are changing out of these calmer times?
Yeah, I think it has some similarities in that, you know, there's some real uncertainties about how the world will evolve in the next 5-10 years. So I think there are some similarities. Maybe more fluid, a little bit more dynamic. This was quite rigid, the way the Cold War was, you know, sitting. But I think it has some similarities.
Okay, we'll talk about a bit later. You're operating across world regions.
Yeah.
What the impact is of that and what you think about. But first, let's talk about your company. ADA Metal Packaging is a global leader in beverage packaging. What are you guys doing?
Yeah, we're making a lot of these. So we make over 45 billion beverage cans per year for all beverage categories. So for alcoholic categories, soft drinks, carbonated soft drinks, energy drinks, still drinks, increasingly waters, new drinks, you know, lots of new formulations. So yeah, we do a lot of that.
Yeah. And who are your customers? Who's buying these?
Big brands. So the Cokes, the Heinekens, the Pepsis, now increasingly new companies growing up in Brazil, the brewers, Petropolis. So yeah, pretty much everyone.
Okay. Very interesting. And I have to say, it tastes very fresh, even the water out of a can.
One of the advantages.
Yeah, one of the advantages. Everyone knows your product. I mean, if you go to the supermarket, you see it on the shelves. And I think your customers are heavily using this for marketing purposes. I think quite trendy at the moment to drink or to use a can, drink out of a can. But how do you make a can? So how does your company work? How do I have to imagine this? I mean, I hold it in my hand. And I think there's also some prints on the can. I think it even also says AMP, ADA Metal Packaging. So talk us a little bit through this for people who love cans but don't know where they come from.
So this week, in fact, I was with one of our suppliers, Spirit. He came out of the Hydro Group out of Norway. So we were in Dusseldorf, where they have the biggest rolling mill, apparently in the world, but definitely in Europe, in a place called Alunorf. So that's where we buy from them a coil of aluminium. So they're rolling aluminium. They get an ingot of aluminium and they put it into a coil, which comes to our plant. So our plants, for the body, they run from a coil through to the body of the can. And so they do it basically by stamping and then pushing at great speed and force the metal to stretch it and create the body, at which point we then take it through the process of decoration. So we do the decorating in the can plant. We coat it to make it to protect the metal from the drinks, and then we neck it, which is this little indentation at the top. In a separate factory, we're making the end, and so that is also a very high speed process.
So that's the lid. The end is the lid, okay?
And a very technical process, because this has to be very easy to open, but also very secure against some highly carbonated drinks. So this is a pretty high tech process and piece of packaging at the end of it. And then we send the bodies and the end separately to our customers, and they fill the drink and then seam the end into the can. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that this is all happening at very high speed. Can you give us some numbers around this? Because I think it's...
3,000 cans per minute is the speed of some of our lines, you know, so imagine that. It's extremely high speed.
So you can hardly see it. And all the decorations or the printing is possible in that speed.
Yeah, we have decorators running at 1,800, 2,000 cans per minute. And then if you have two decorators, obviously you can run through the line and get your 3,000 at the end of the line. So yeah, it's an unbelievably high speed process.
And the numbers on this, what do they stand for? I mean, without going to the details, but just for interested people.
They basically will tell you where it was manufactured and when it was manufactured. So if we have any quality issues with the customers, they come back to us. We can trace them to the line and the time, and that allows us to track down any issues.
So looking at the business right now, how has it been going over the past 2 years or so, and looking forward?
Yeah, it's actually been really good. So, we had a reset in 22, 23, but 24 and 25 have been very good for us. Probably the big underpin for that has been the growth of the energy drinks category in North America, particularly last year. We see a lot of innovation in that space. We see new players coming into the space, and we're with many of those players. So we've had great growth, you know, high single digit growth in a pretty stable category, you know, of beverage cans.
And how do you win these new players? What's your secret trick around that?
I think we were very collaborative with smaller customers, with newer customers. We weren't, and in COVID times, things got quite tight, right? People were making choices around customers, and we were always keen to look after all customers, large, medium, small customers. And I think that was somewhat differentiating. And I think those customers recognized we did that. And then they've grown much more than you might have expected. So I think that was definitely part of the, particularly that I think the North American team did a great job of looking after that kind of customer, you know, both relationship-wise, you know, contractually, and then down at the, you know, on the service line every day. And so that's really supported us. But equally, Europe has had, you know, good growth in cans, obviously lower energy costs than other pack types, you know, not plastic, you know. So I think, you know, we've been very encouraged by the last couple of years, and we see that growth persisting, you know, as we go into this year, next year, and years beyond. So I think we're very happy with where we're sitting.
Yeah. And when you go to the office in the morning, what excites you about AMP?
What's really interesting about a business like AMP is that on the outside, it looks like a relatively simple business. You know, you sort of make a can, sell a can. But actually, these businesses are extremely strategic. They need a lot of thinking because they're big investments on big cycles. You've got to make these choices. You've got to be in the right place. If you make them wrong, you're out of kilter for quite a long time. It's very dynamic. Our competition are strong. They're investing. Our customers are extremely aggressive, looking to lower their costs. And so they're always putting pressure back into the supply chain. We're working with big suppliers as well, making sure. And the supply chain is very volatile right now. And so our procurement and supply chain teams have to do a fabulous job and have done a fabulous job to deal with the volatility that we see in the world. So you have all of this in what looks like a simple business. It's really not simple. And then you have this very exciting, cool manufacturing line that does incredible things to produce so many cans at such high quality, so, you know, so fast and at so low cost. So you also have that underpinning the business. And again, you look at it from the outside, you don't think of this as a sexy industry, right? We're not high tech. We're not talking about AI. We're not saving the world. But actually, it's a really interesting company and industry to work in.
And how do you, with all these challenges, strategic, operational, investments, taking the people along, how do you build a team and develop a team that can actually do that?
Oh, you've got to recruit good people, and you've got to retain good people, and you've got to treat them right, you know? And I think a big part of leadership is that your first line, right? Is really taking time and looking after them and motivating them and being there for them and building trust with them. I think we've done that. I think we have a really strong team, and that you know, it does start there, right? Because then they'll recruit good people, and then they'll recruit good people, and they'll motivate good people, and they'll behave in the right way, and they'll show the right values. And that's how you build the culture. And I think that's a big focus for leaders.
So you're operating Germany in Europe more broadly, but also North America and South America. As a global CEO, where do you spend your thinking time?
Yeah, in all those places. I think every region has its challenges and opportunities. So I think, you know, Brazil is one of the best markets for cans, actually, interestingly. Lot of growth over the years, but now, you know, more difficult the last few years, but turbulent. Amazing recycling rates, nearly 100% recycled, which is very good. And North America has always been the big can market. It went through a period of not growing so much, but now it's all the innovation is going into the can in North America, all the beverage innovation. And so we see growth and these exciting new brands, and we're fortunate to serve many of those brands. So that's also very interesting. And then Europe, again, a good growth market for cans. Obviously, a difficult environment with the consumer, cost of living challenges, but the can has been the winner in that mix. But I guess there's sort of that picture of how I spent my thinking time. But then, actually, increasingly, it's more global thinking. We've been on a journey to go from being a bit less regional in our organization and operating model to be a bit more global and regional, and bring the best of our global functions, our operations, our procurement, our sustainability, our planning, and work more as one AMP.
Mm-hmm. So that shift is on top of your mind, in addition to the regional success.
Exactly. And that's been a big piece of the last couple of years to drive that.
Okay, so super. Let's talk about that strategy more specifically now.
The secret sauce.
Olli, you're the CEO of a $5 billion revenue global packaging company. What is your strategy?
We developed a strategy map that we try and keep relatively simple. It has four big pillars. Partnering for value, where we try and differentiate in the way we interact with our customers and our suppliers. Cost leadership, we're essentially a commodity type product. We have to be always, you know, at the forefront of our cost base. We have strong future, which is where we think about the regulation, the way the world is developing, and we think about our investment plans. And then we have our people pillar, obviously underpinning the whole thing. So our strategy is really to drive those initiatives that sit under that across the company.
And when you think about it, the strategy, what excites you most about it, or where would you like to bring AMP in the next couple of years?
So I think that, you know, what we have built, and we really had to build it, you know, we were formed out of a divestment after a big merger, and we were actually formed out of three different companies. So the regions were actually formed out of divestments from different two different companies and a joint venture. So I think what we have done is formed a company and formed a culture, and the bit of the strategy map where I think we see that distinctive is particularly in this partnering area, the partnering for value. I think we do interact differently with our customers, with our suppliers. We work collaboratively. It's not that we're not tough where we need to be. It's a tough industry. You've got to be able to negotiate. We have big customers who negotiate pretty aggressively. But I think we do work well with our customers and suppliers and slightly differently. And at all levels, you know, right through the organization down to the day-to-day service we provide. So that always excites me when I think about AMP. And then I think the other piece is what I just talked about. I'm excited to see us take the best of what we do and drive it globally, because obviously we do exactly the same thing in all three regions, and a chem plant is a chem plant. And therefore, if we really take the best of what we do, we can improve our performance everywhere.
Yeah. And how do you do that as a global CEO, as a global leadership team in such a company? You see something is working really well in one location or one country or one region. How do you make that happen, that you get to this value that you have created, where it's becoming one company and you're following the winning recipe, so to say? How do you do that? If you had to recommend this to other global CEOs who are on this journey, what's the way to do that?
I think you can use different levers. So, I mean, for example, in our procurement function, we can use the reporting line. We have a hard line reporting through the organization, and therefore that you ask the global procurement lead to drive in their function excellence and to understand what's happening in all regions. Obviously, there's always the matrix working very collaboratively with regional leadership. But then if you look at our operations area, we haven't done that. What we've done there is launched a program called the Ardagh Metal Production System, which is then more of a way of working and an attempt also to drive a different culture through the plants of excellence, lean manufacturing. And then you're using much more obviously tools, so we assess them, then we bring training, then we increasingly using technology, and then you do communication and engagement. So we're running base camps where we bring people together and talk about what best practice looks like and talk about how we can help, particularly new people. You know, we have big turnover in our plants. The can industry grew particularly 30, 40 years ago. And then people stayed. And then we see them retiring with a lot of expertise. So we're also having to change the way we work and train people. And so that one, we're very keen not to call it a program, because I think a program sort of says, you know, it's from here to here and then it'll stop. But much more a way of thinking and a way of working. So that one, yeah, that's a change initiative, if you like, that we're using to drive best practice.
Yeah, that sounds really fundamental. And if you look at things like this, how do you capture whether these things truly work?
I mean, obviously, we have some very hard data on the efficiency of our plants, the spoilage, so the waste, on the costs. So one sense is this, right? Then we also have this assessment methodology where we actually go beneath that and look at what practices are in the plant and whether those practices are supporting the KPIs, the output. And then we're also running engagement surveys around this program to say, are people seeing that it improves their lives? Because we've talked about it, you know, every day is your best day. You know, we're trying to make it so, because a chem plant is actually quite a tough environment, right? It's hot, it's noisy, it's difficult. When it goes wrong, you don't have much time. It's very fast. We lose a lot of production very quickly. So in that sense, it's quite stressful. And that's particularly if you're new and still learning it. So we're trying to make the job better for people to enjoy their work. And obviously we can get feedback on that.
Yeah. And what are people saying?
Yeah, we're getting good engagement now. I mean, these things always take longer than you think, right? I mean, we're nearly in year three, I mean, but we're certainly in year two. And, you know, it takes a lot of time to gear it up and to get the engagement to help shape it. We tried to get a lot of engagement in the way we designed it. But yeah, we're definitely seeing good feedback now.
Okay, so back to your strategy a little bit. I mean, we are in the middle of it. Your industry is CapEx heavy, footprint is very important, cost you mentioned, scale. So how do you really win in a market like this? And you mentioned that it's a commodity-like business. Is it actually possible to differentiate in a market like this, or are there other factors that play a key role here?
So look, cans are relatively low switching costs, making them more like a commodity. Obviously, new sizes, new designs, you know, reduce that element and increase switching costs. But yeah, we have to recognize we're in that kind of market and people make good returns in those kinds of markets. I think that we're not, and clearly also then it is very structural. So where we put a can plant, you can't transport cans very far because it's a lot of air on a relatively low value product.
So location, transport, logistics is a key success.
It's hugely key. So doing good investments in the right markets with, you know, near the right customer filling locations is very, very important. So you can't get away from those things. And it's a capital, as you say, intensive industry with relatively few players who are able to put that capital down and then make those plants work at the speeds and efficiencies that they need to work. So it's a consolidated industry. And in that sense, you're not, it's not that you're massively differentiating because, you know, the market's growing, there's room for everybody to serve customers. But I think where we do, again, I mentioned it before, try to find an edge is on this interaction with customers, suppliers, the way we're collaborating and the way we're working with them in their strategies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is your partnering
For value.
For value.
Yeah.
And when you think about overall strategy, design, making it happen, you talked about your global initiatives that that you aim to deeply root in the DNA of AMP. Could you rank a little bit what do you think is very relevant for success? So clarity, strategic clarity on what needs to happen, then execution excellence, organizational buy-in, or leadership capabilities around it. Just very briefly, what's your sentiment? What matters most here?
Yeah, look, I obviously have a bias towards the strategy element because I think it gets underplayed nowadays. There's these funny quotes like culture eats strategy for breakfast, and you're like, well, maybe. You know, I mean, let's see if you have the wrong strategy. Let's see where that culture ends up, you know, because you can end up in a very bad place. So I'm obviously biased towards making some good decisions and making those decisions every day strategically. And I see companies that do that and don't do that. And I think you end up in some very challenging places if you make poor strategic choices. The organization can fight and fight and fight to try and resolve, but won't resolve because you're in a structurally difficult spot. So I think don't start without the strategy. You know, everything else is clearly critical. You're never going to get there without leadership, execution, without buy-in, but start on the right things, you know, and then the rest, yeah, you can spend a lot of time focusing on that.
Okay, clear leadership words from you. Let's talk about what makes a good leader.
Der menschliche Moment.
I have an interesting question for you. As a global CEO, or more generalized, how human can global CEOs be?
As human as they like. I mean, I think that they have to be human. You know, you're leading a human organization, and if you're not human, no one's going to come with you. Obviously, you, and maybe this underlies the question, you have to make difficult decisions that impact other human beings, but you have to do that for the good of the company. You have no choice. And these are difficult, painful decisions. We had to close a plant in the US. Obviously, these are difficult decisions, but I think that actually, at these points, it's critical to be human, to be open, to explain, to lay out why, you know, we had to do that in a human way. So, yeah, I don't see any trade-off there.
Yeah. And for you, in let's say, good, busy or challenging, busy times, would you have some specific examples or maybe personal operating principles, what makes a good human CEO?
I think it's that piece of just being very clear and communicating around what decisions we're making and why. So we weren't big on communication, if we're honest, as a culture, and that was a group, also part of the group, and we've introduced a communication device called AMP Talks, where we every quarter or so we just have everybody sending questions, and then myself and other members of the leadership team sit in a situation like this and talk to the cameras and answer questions. And we also have it, we've done some also with live Q&A, which I really like, where, you know, the Q&A is coming in and you can just respond to it immediately and connect. And I think this is the critical thing, that they see why you're making the decisions, what's behind it, what trade-offs we're dealing with, and are just open about it.
Mm. And the topic of artificial intelligence, AI, is that being discussed in these conversations, or how are you addressing this at the moment in AMP?
Yeah, I mean, we're thinking about it a lot. I wouldn't say we made a huge amount of progress. You know, I think obviously in the operations area, we have a program, the Plant of the Future program. And I think there what we've done well and are head of global operations has done well is to develop actually a target operating model that isn't about technology. It's about how we want the plant to be better for production, for our people, for output, for costs, and then identify the areas of the plant where there are possibilities to improve, and then say, okay, what technology or non-technology solutions could help with that use case? And there, I think we start to trial now some AI type solutions, particularly in the areas of sort of training. I think we see opportunities. We still, the chem plant produces a huge amount of data, much of which is not looked at and therefore isn't really controlled for its quality. And therefore, we still don't yet see these new technologies solving for the efficiency and the throughput, but that will come, I guess.
Mm. And so we've touched on AI now. You lead across these three global regions. And then I think you mentioned that there were some challenging decisions that you had to take in the past, but then there's also a lot of growth opportunities. So navigating also emotionally with the workforce and the organization more broadly along these waves of, okay, something positive is happening. There's maybe a strong growth ambition for a period of time. And then also there's some fallback again or so. How do you do that from a leadership perspective? How do you, apart from this, the talks, are you very present in the regions? How does that work? How do I stay close and get the feeling whether the organization actually embraces what's needed now?
It's a really interesting question, because we did go through a big growth phase. So we invested $2 billion in the business between 2019 and 2024 off the back of COVID lockdowns, a lot of people buying, you know, through retail rather than going to bars and restaurants. And so we saw a lot of growth. We saw these new drinks coming in. And then there was a big pullback in 2022 and 2023, you know, initially triggered by post-COVID inflation, then the war in Europe and the inflation that came from that, and then, you know, cost of living challenges. And that was tough, because I think we were in that space before where it's like, yeah, let's build another plant. Where's your next growth idea? And that obviously is nice, right? And then, you know, it's, oh, we need some more people to do that. That's obviously, and then suddenly we were in, oh, no, all of that stops. I don't think there's an easy way through that. I think, all you can do is say, this is what we're seeing. This is where the market's at. This is where our shareholders are at. You can see it externally. This is our new reality. We have to deal with this. And yeah, that was not easy, actually, that period. But it wasn't easy up and down the organization. They could see it wasn't easy also for us. You know, we were out there in earnings calls, you know, getting asked very pointed questions. So I think it's just, yeah, you have to face reality as it is.
Yeah. Is there one big mindset shift that you had to follow, or that you had to ask your core leadership team to follow when you really strategically transitioned from growth into, let's say, stabilization or something like this, or the other way around? Is there something where you really have to be the front runner on certain behavioral things as well?
I definitely had to be articulating our journey, our story. You know, we'd put in the capital, now we need to grow into the capital. I needed to take the place of the shareholders inside the company to say, look, they put a lot of money in, they need the returns from the money. That's what we're all here for now, is to drive the company very strongly for efficiency and utilization over the next few years to pay back this huge amount, and to remind people that although it feels a little bit less good, that the growth isn't quite what we expected, we're still growing in an industry's, not many industries are growing, you know, we're still in a great industry, but we now need to fulfill our commitments when we asked for this capital, and to hold that place, I think, and to drive that narrative. I mean, I'm not a big believer, I mean, obviously, you know, all the kind of travel bans and kind of cutting this and cutting that. I mean, it's like either you drive your company in a lean and sensible way and people travel for the right reasons, or you don't. So I find all that a little bit less effective, if I'm honest. I think either we should do the right things in a very cost-effective way, because that's the kind of industry we're in.
Yeah, and it's a super attractive industry and with a very attractive product. You mentioned before that it's also an old industry with a lot of people, with a lot of experience now retiring. So when you maybe address younger people that are listening to the podcast, what's in it for people who are potentially interested in joining a company like AMP? Is there a good future? What is, so to say, the opportunity to work in the beverage packaging industry?
It is a growth industry, and there is a, you know, people are going to drink drinks out of cans, you know, and AI isn't removing some very physical machinery that's driving, you know, making a can. So I think actually, and we've seen it, I mean, you know, a lot of industries have been offshored off to Asia or whatever. You can't offshore beverage cans because if you ship them from Asia, they cost an awful lot and they get very damaged. So, and we've tried. And so I think, you know, it is an industry that will remain domestic and regional. It is an industry that, and then I actually think that heavy manufacturing is really cool. I mean, honestly, you go to our plants, it's amazing watching the speed of what we do and the technology we're deploying. And we're obviously making it better every day. And I think that's really interesting. Yeah.
Okay, that sounds tempting. So let's get more concrete in our last section.
Butter by die Fische.
Okay, a few very direct questions. Fast decisions or thinking time?
Yeah, probably a bit more thinking. I'm not afraid of decisions, but I like to do the thinking.
The biggest difference between English and German leaders?
You know this answer. So very direct communication from German leaders, very indirect communication from English leaders.
Anything you regret?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, not a lot, to be honest, because it's not a helpful emotion, but maybe I could have left consulting a few years earlier with a bit more confidence that it would work out. Because I've really enjoyed this second period of my career. I enjoyed the consulting. I thought BCG still do, great company. But yeah, I think if I'd gone a few years earlier, maybe could have done a few more things. Maybe that one.
What are you proud of?
You know, apart from kids and things like that. I mean, I'm proud of what we did with AMP. I mean, I think it was not obvious, you know, with the divestment, as I say, of three separate businesses regionally, merging with a quite unusual entrepreneurial group, the Ardagh Group, some of the challenges we faced as the group's gone through difficult times. And I think we have formed a company at the end of that with a culture, with a distinctiveness, and with a great group of people that is successful. So yeah, I am proud of that.
We've just started into the year. What's your personal wish for 2026?
Yeah, personal wish is easy. I mean, I think that's, you know, family, colleagues, everyone healthy, safe, you know, no serious accidents. It's that. I think if it's a personal wish, it's definitely that. Obviously, I want the company to be successful. But
okay. Ollie, thank you. At the end of our podcast, our guests have to open their calendars for us. So what is on your agenda in the next couple of weeks?
Oh, well, so we have an exciting leadership team meeting in Zug. Our European business is headquartered in Switzerland. We're bringing together the global leadership team. We're also meeting with our new executive chairman at the group level and talking strategy and long-range plan. So yeah, that should be a really energizing meeting. And then actually I'm taking a few days off. And then I have my board meeting at the end of the month in Luxembourg.
Okay. Thank you very much, Olli, for your time and your inspiring insights. Truly appreciate it, and I wish you and the entire team at AMP all the success.
Thanks very much.
Good having you. Tolle Episode mit Oliver Graham an die unruhige Zeiten-Zuhörer. Wenn euch die Episode gefallen hat, lasst uns eine gute Bewertung da. Schickt uns Vorschläge an hello@tte-strategy.com. Und der Podcast ist ein Format von TTE Strategy. Und wenn ihr Ruhe und Routine in euren unruhigen Alltag bringen wollt, hört wieder rein bei Unruhige Zeiten.
Unruhige Zeiten.